From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Despite Iraqi assurances that elections will take place on January 30th, it's unclear who will be there to report on them. Much of the foreign media stays sequestered in the few remaining secure areas, sending Iraqi fixers to do their reporting. And it's these fixers and homegrown Iraqi reporters who are at the greatest risk. Dozens of Iraqi journalists have been killed on the job since the war began. And this week, as Prime Minister Alawi declared portions of Iraq too dangerous for Iraqis to vote, it's clear that covering the elections will be no less risky. Hiwa Osman directs the training of Iraqi journalists for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. A poll conducted by his group found that most Iraqis believe they'll be voting for a president, not for a 275-seat interim National Assembly.
There is a huge information gap here in Iraq. Sources of news about Iraq are divided into two categories: international media outlets, that includes the Arab satellite channels, and also the international media outlets like NPR and BBC and others, and especially those who have Arabic service as well. Iraqis rely on them for news, but they feel that the Iraqi story is seen with a Washington eye or with a London eye. The audience are the people who live in the United States or in the West in general. And as far as the Arab satellite channels are concerned, with every day that passes, their Sunni Islamist agenda is becoming more and more prominent in their reporting. Quite a few Iraqis today say that these Arab satellite channels and other Arab media outlets are having a nervous breakdown because Iraq has lost its Sunni Arab identity. Iraq is neither fully Arab nor fully Sunni. It's Shiite and Kurdish and also Sunni. So as a result, there is a serious gap. The public service broadcaster that was set up by the Coalition Provisional Authority has failed miserably. And
I think they subcontracted that service out to a Lebanese media company, didn't they?
It was initially contracted out to an American outlet, which is called Harris. I think they are a defense contractor. They then subcontracted it to a Lebanese company. And most of the content is heavily influenced by Lebanese culture and not Iraqi culture. Knowing what type of information do Iraqis need seemed to be impossible for the Lebanese managers of that station.
So, Hiwa, what you're describing is a kind of landscape of shadows where the average Iraqi can either get an American slant or a British slant or a Lebanese slant. In other words, they can find everybody's take except one that they themselves can use.
Exactly. I mean, to know what the situation is in Iraq, you have to buy almost 10 newspapers in Baghdad. You have to listen to 5 or 6 or even 10 radio stations to find out what the real picture is in Iraq. The other Iraqi outlets, apart from the Iraqi public service broadcaster, are the political party media outlets. Again, the journalists who work there, most of them are still suffering from the Ba'athist hangover. They're still operating in the same old ways. To them, it's only a new sheriff in town. They praise the new party. They praise maybe the prime minister or the president. In every society, media or journalism should reflect society's dialogue with itself. In Iraq, so far, for over 35 years, it's been a society of monologue. It's not a society of dialogue. That's why all these individual outlets have not been able to break that norm and start a true dialogue within society or debate.
So let's get down finally to the last 2 weeks of this month. A lot of the details of the upcoming election are being kept a secret to protect the candidates. In fact, even the candidates' names in many cases are being withheld. You can only vote for the party. How are your journalists getting around this problem, and how is the potential Iraqi electorate getting around it?
Well, I think Iraqis are not going to only vote for the party. They will be voting for their ethnic identity. And I think this election is repeating the mistake that took place 80 years ago when the Iraqi state was put together. Today in Iraq, a Kurd will vote for the Kurdish list, a Shiite will vote for the Shiite list, and a Sunni will vote for the Sunni list if they decided to take part in the election. Every individual in Iraq will have to make a decision on his or her identity. And I think that will end the Iraqi identity of the individuals who live within the borders of what's called today Iraq. For this reason, we are planning to send our reporters to almost all of the cities. I think we will do the story from areas where the international journalists cannot get to. We are hoping to get the stories from neighborhoods, from real families. Our reporters, because they are from the neighborhood, the average Iraqi individuals feel more comfortable telling them the actual story.
Is there any way that the rest of us will get a chance to hear what the Iraqis really think?
For the duration of the election, we are planning to provide a daily coverage of events from around the country. I think the plan is for, with the help of local partners, we will have an English service for the international community, a Kurdish service for the Kurdish speakers of Iraq, and an Arabic service for the Arabic speakers of Iraq.
And where can our listeners log on to that?
It's www.IWPR, the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, IWPR.net.
Hiwa, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hiwa Osman is an editor and training director for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and he spoke to us from Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan.
This week, Mahmoud Abbas was elected the new leader of the Palestinian Authority. His victory capped a heated campaign season that played itself out in a variety of Palestinian and pan-Arab media outlets. While the world watched closely, the Palestinians engaged through the press in a process of self-criticism and debate about their options. Shibley Telhami followed the media throughout the campaign. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and author of the forthcoming book Reflections of Hearts and Minds, Media, Opinion, and Identity in the Arab World. Professor Telhami, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
You've done a lot of polling of Arabs about their media diets. What kind of media were average Palestinians paying attention to during this campaign season?
There are a lot of Palestinian print media, and those are certainly read by a lot of people, not just elites. They tend to really be relatively stale and safe. More often than not, they reflect the broad views of the elites. In general, Palestinians continued to watch the Arab satellite media, and Al Jazeera is still the most popular by far, like in the rest of the Arab world. But more attention was paid, certainly as the election got nearer and during election day, to the Palestinian television station, which covered issues related to the election almost all the time, including pictures live from various places, guests who were coming as observers to the Palestinian areas, as well as Palestinian analysts who had exit poll results and could talk about them. Clearly that mattered, although by and large, there was an implicit kind of tone favoring Mahmoud Abbas.
You said that the Palestinian papers are read, but not necessarily voraciously read. Why don't they have more of an impact?
By and large, I think the papers have limited resources. They really are almost late in updating the story. They borrow a lot of stories from the outside world. They don't have a lot of active reporters beyond the Palestinian areas. So in general, the news that they get on television is not only more colorful, but it's more up to date. There's more diversity. It's more important for a lot of people to watch.
From your perspective, do Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, for example, really understand the subtleties of life inside of the occupied territories? Or are they, let's just say, a little on the polemical side?
If you look at the satellite Arab media and you compare it with Arab television 15 years ago, which was mostly monopolized by governments, really advocating essentially a government point of view in every single Arab state, they're far better than before, even despite the limitations. What you see now is far more diversity, far more real coverage from the ground, openness in the discourse, far more opposing views than the Arab world has ever witnessed. Now, obviously what happens in those kind of situations where you have a marketplace, you have a market dynamic that takes over. And that market dynamic ultimately also leads to a little more sensationalism on some issues. But at the same time, there's actually more coverage, more real coverage, more information than Arabs have ever been exposed to.
Let's talk for a moment about how Abbas used the media to reach out to the various constituencies. His predecessor, Yasser Arafat, was famous for delivering one message in English, mainly for Western consumption, and an entirely different message in Arabic for domestic consumption. Mahmoud Abbas didn't do exactly that, did he?
In general, I think he had a unified message. And What he sought to do was differentiate at least his position on issues in a way that balanced the interest of his own constituency, his need for a continued working relationship with Israel, and support from the Bush administration. The way he did that was that he assumed that the red line in his relationship with Israel and with the Bush administration was the issue of violence. And so he took a very clear position against it. On the other hand, he clearly took positions on final settlement issue, particularly the refugee issues, that were tough, that were very much at home with the vast majority of the Palestinians, and in fact very much at home with the position that Arafat had articulated, assuming that it wouldn't affect so much the relationship with Israel, because in the end, those issues are going to have to be negotiated. So taking a negotiating position in and of itself is not a threat.
Abbas obviously faces enormous challenges as he takes over. There's corruption, there's poverty, hopelessness. The way that the debate is framed, particularly on the pan-Arabic satellite channels, is it actually impossible for him to make any headway?
I don't think he's going to be able to use the media in a way that is going to affect his strategy or affect the way people are going to see him. He might be able to do it in the short term, by virtue of getting a lot of support from around the world. Remember that when Palestinians are turning on television, they also see Jordanian television, Egyptian television, and Lebanese television. And most of the governments in the Arab world, they want to see him succeed. They're rooting for him because it helps them in a way project that there is a process. And also they really don't want to see Hamas win. They clearly want the PLO hierarchy to be able to withstand the assault by Hamas. And so in that sense, the government media around is going to be giving him relatively good press. The U.S. in the short term will be rooting for him. But in the end, I think people are going to judge him by what happens on the ground.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Take care.
Shibli Talhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. His next book will be titled Reflections of Hearts and Minds, Media, Opinion, and Identity in the Arab World.
Coming up, collateral damage from the predations of a paid-off pundit and the many meanings of Michael Moore.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here's a catchy quote. The president is whistling two tunes on Social Security, and it's time for him to come clean. If that sounds like partisan rhetoric, well, that's exactly what it is. One of last week's talking points, courtesy of the brand new Senate Democratic Communications Center. Still smarting from their big losses in November's election, losses facilitated by the Republican sophisticated message machine, Democrats this month opened their first permanent communications war room on the Hill. It operates out of the office of new Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, and it's run by longtime Democratic media operative Jim Manley. Jim joins me now from a payphone at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
So are we talking about the same kind of war room that's set up by both sides during the presidential campaigns, message of the day, opposition research, rapid response, and so on?
Yeah, in that respect, it's entirely similar. But what's unusual about this situation is that it's actually going to be working out of the United States Senate. So we have to, you know, follow the customs and traditions and the decorum of the Senate in operating. But, you know, the attempt is to try and reach beyond the beltway and try and, you know, reach the broader constituency that's in this country.
What kinds of things will you be taking from the Republican playbook?
Well, you know, what we saw in November was a very aggressive use of the Internet by the Republican Party and different Republican-affiliated organizations. There was an interesting situation in South Dakota, for instance, in the race against Senator Daschle, where the conservative blogs were very effective in trying to help defeat Senator Daschle. That was a lesson learned by many up on the Hill, and we vowed never to allow that to happen again. So one of the cutting-edge aspects of this operation is an increased use of the Internet to work with the blogs and whatnot.
Here's what strikes me as a central challenge for you guys. Senator Kennedy, in a speech to the National Press Club on Wednesday, said this.
We cannot become Republican clones. If we do, we will lose again and deserve to lose. As I have said on other occasions, the last thing our country needs is two Republican parties.
Now, Kennedy forthrightly stated what he believes the future of the party should be, but as he suggests, there's a tug of war going on within the party right now, and how can you hone a message if you can't come to a consensus on what it is?
Sure, I'd probably have to disagree a little bit with the premise of your question. In my 13 years on the Hill, I've never seen a caucus that's more united as they are at this point in time.
Would you be willing to concede that part of the problem isn't that you've been old-fashioned in the way that you get out the message, but maybe that the message itself has become muddled?
No, I'm not willing to concede that at all. I think every reputable poll we saw after the November election demonstrated that, again, on the core issues, on education, health care, better jobs, stronger economy, the American people inevitably choose the Democrats over the Republicans. We just have to do a better job of getting out the message. I mean, what we saw in the last election was a very aggressive operation by the Republican Party designed to try and demonize Senator Kerry and his supporters. And Senator Reid has vowed that that's not going to happen again, at least to Senate Democrats.
And are you ready to go out there and do some demonization yourself?
We're ready to take them on wherever and whenever possible.
Okay. Jim Manley, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jim Manley is staff director of the newly formed Senate Democratic Communications Center, which opened for business this month. Joining me now to throw in some context is Harry Jaffe, national editor for The Washingtonian magazine. Harry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So what do you make of this new effort by the Senate Democratic Caucus?
Well, I think there's actually an opening here because the Republicans are not nearly as aggressive as they were in the Trent Lott days. And let's not forget about the fact that this is the greatest deliberative body in the world. And they're so used to being kind of sweet to one another, my colleague this and my colleague that. And the Democrats have kind of been working on that principle for the last, you know, many decades. And all of a sudden, they're waking up to the fact that the Republicans are no longer so collegial. And I think it's about time. Whether they can actually get organized and make any headway, we'll have to see. But there's one thing about being in the minority, and that is that you can actually organize around that principle, and the pressure can accrue to the benefit of a single message, and a war room to get that message across, I think, is, for their part, kind of a major advance.
But as I asked Manley, do the Democrats have a single message? It seems like they're arguing amongst themselves about the future direction of the party.
The Democrats' problem is they have nothing positive to say. But they can organize in a defensive way, which they will do around the change in Social Security. And they also will have something to organize around when it comes to the judicial appointments, protecting their rights to filibuster. I think that their problem now and in the future is what are they doing offensively?
Given the astoundingly effective media management skills of the Republicans, do you think that the Democratic message machine stands a fighting chance?
Oh, absolutely, in this case, because let's think about Social Security for a second. On the side of the Democrats here, you have the AARP, no slouch in getting out the message and organizing its members. Plus, I think one of the interesting things that's going to happen in the next session of Congress is that the Republicans are going to start to see fissures in their once impregnable fortress. I think that there are many, many Republicans who are not quite as adamant and secure about the notion of privatizing Social Security as the president is. And I think that it leaves an opportunity for the Democrats to exploit that indecisiveness within the Republican Party. What's surprising to me is that Harry Reid, who everyone thought was, you know, mild-mannered senator from Nevada, is actually endeavoring to change the course of how the Democrats in the Senate engage the Republicans. This is, at this particular moment, a very, very shrewd thing to do because it is the majority party that has so much going for it that might, in fact, drop the ball, whatever metaphor you want to use. Look what happened to the Democrats when they had been in the majority for decades and decades. They left an opening for the minority to come in.
Harry, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Harry Jaffe is national editor at The Washingtonian Magazine.
Last year, the Howard Dean campaign made headlines for its innovative use of the Internet. Then, on Friday, The Wall Street Journal quoted Zephyr Teachout, former Dean campaign aide turned blogger, saying that the campaign had at one point hired two bloggers as consultants but was really trying to buy their goodwill. Teachout said the bloggers were never explicitly asked to promote Dean, but ought to reconsider their ethics anyway. Still, in one case, the blogger ceased to blog while under contract. In the other, involving the author of the very successful blog The Daily Kos, the consultancy was fully and repeatedly disclosed to his readers and anyone else who cared.
There was no such disclosure for the readers of Armstrong Williams' column or the audiences of his radio and TV shows. They knew he liked the president's No Child Left Behind Act. The conservative black pundit had carved out a niche for himself as the rare minority purveyor of GOP talking points. But they didn't know that he was being paid explicitly to promote it by the Department of Education. Democratic members of Congress howled when they learned of the $240,000 taxpayer dollars funneled to Armstrong to promote No Child Left Behind. The deal has sparked calls for investigation, since the Bush administration had been found guilty twice before of illegally propagandizing with public money.
And, of course, the flap has cost Williams his newspaper syndication deal and his journalistic reputation. Joining me now is Deborah Mathis, assistant professor at the Medill School of Journalism, Gannett News Service columnist, and sometimes Armstrong Williams TV foil. Deborah, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
For those listeners out there who might never have heard of Armstrong Williams before last week, who is this guy?
He's quite a character, I have to say. He came to Washington from South Carolina as an aide to then-Senator Jesse Helms. He befriended and became a really staunch advocate, one of the few in the black community of any prominence, of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. So he's a diehard conservative, tied in with the Republican Party, helping with the outreach to the black community. And now he's a pariah.
Now, you have a connection to Armstrong Williams, too, because you've worked with him or against him quite a bit over the years, no?
For almost 10 years, he and I were friendly adversaries, I guess you would say, on America's Black Forum. And that program is in about 100 markets. We agreed on almost nothing, but we did become friends. I learned to like Armstrong despite our differences.
Now, what did the Education Department think it was getting by signing this contract with Armstrong?
This is the real kind of irony of this whole thing. Of all the people in black America to carry influence with black Americans, Armstrong Williams was one of the last ones they should have gone to. I mean, they paid the wrong guy because black America has always been, and of course I'm speaking in generalities here, greatly suspicious of Armstrong because he'd pretty much made a living by being a favorite and a friend of the conservative movement. There are black conservatives who are there to raise a little hell within the established conservative community and to open some eyes, and there are others who are there to go along. And I think Armstrong was seen as one who went along and did so eagerly and was handsomely rewarded for it.
So on top of all the other sins committed here by the Department of Education, the move was also condescending to imagine that black America would listen to Armstrong Williams just because he happens to be black.
Absolutely. This administration, and it's not the only one that has ever committed this sin, but this administration especially does not understand black America. The idea that you can pay someone to say a few kind things in the few seconds that anyone is allowed on a television talk show or in other formats to talk about No Child Left Behind, and to think that the black community will then be swayed without paying attention to what they know to be true in terms of their own children's lives in the schools, the overcrowding, the unfair testing, the underpaid teachers, the violence in the schools, all of these things, that we will somehow ignore that and be swayed by one black man saying it's a good law, shows that there's no real respect or at the very least no true understanding of what black America thinks.
You are one of the rather small universe of nationally distributed black pundits. Is this going to affect you personally?
No. I have heard no generalizations about black reporters, black pundits, black people named Armstrong, any of that whatsoever. And that is a function of there having been so many of us now from so many different areas and takes and styles and experiences that people are forced to see us as individuals more. It's really hard to see us as one writhing mass of blackness anymore.
Have you spoken to Williams since this story broke?
A couple of times, yes. And he's heartbroken.
He evidently told David Korn of The Nation that, quote, this happens all the time, that there are others who have been, you know, on the take from one interest group or another. Did he share with you any of those names?
To my knowledge, he has shared names with no one. I don't think that that's a very common practice. I certainly don't think it happens among the ones that are really journalists. Now, who's a journalist these days? So who might he be talking about? I don't know. I think that it behooves the Congress to press on with an investigation about this, because this cannot be for the sake of government and taxpayers who by no means should be funding propaganda, and it can't be for the sake of media, which does not need another slap.
Well, Deborah, thanks very much.
Such a pleasure.
Deborah Mathis teaches at the Medill School of Journalism and writes a national column for the Gannett News Service.
Every once in a while, we examine words that percolate up through the media, sometimes with new meanings. And lately, we've encountered an interesting one, Michael Moore, used as an adjective or a state of mind. Mostly, his name has been invoked to describe a kind of liberal, the bad kind, as in a recent congressional hearing.
Mr. Speaker, my colleagues across the aisle have two sides to choose from. The John Kerry side that acknowledges the election is over and President Bush has won, or the Michael Moore side that defines democracy as Democrats going to the polls and conspiracy as Republicans going to the polls.
January is just 2 weeks old, and Moore has turned up repeatedly on cable news, on CNN's Crossfire, and several times on Fox News, such as when Sean Hannity referred to the, quote, Michael Moore model of hatred. But the coup de grace, for us anyway, was last Sunday, during the series opener of the Fox action show 24, when the fictional Secretary of Defense invoked Michael Moore the adjective in an argument with his son.
It will humiliate the president, and it will be dangerous to national security.
What could be more dangerous than 2,500 missile delivery systems?
Oh, spare me your sixth grade Michael Moore logic.
You know, you used to have Scoop Jackson Democrats, which meant Democrats who were tough on communism. You used to have Reagan Democrats, which meant Democrats who voted for Republicans. And now we have Michael Moore Democrats, and it's not altogether clear what it means.
Chris Sullentrop is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Slate.
Look, the Republicans are very good at this. The Democrats like to tar Republicans as extremists. That's one of the favorite Democrat words. But Republicans have come up with one individual in particular extremist and tried to say that all the Democrats are that guy. To be fair, not only Republicans are bandying around this Michael Moore label. Peter Beinart, the editor of The New Republic, mentioned Michael Moore in a much-talked-about article in Washington about how to redefine the Democratic Party, and he talked about wanting to purge the Democrats of what he called the Michael Moore and move-on factions. In some sense, people think Michael Moore Democrat means the kind of Democrat I don't like. Peter Beinart used it to mean peacenik Democrat. The Secretary of Defense in 24 used it to mean protester Democrat.
Howard Dean recently put in his name for nomination as chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. Don't you think Howard Dean Democrat has a pretty good ring?
Absolutely. And if Howard Dean becomes chairman of the DNC, I guarantee you people will immediately call him a Michael Moore Democrat. You know, whether it's because they think he's against the war or whether it's because they think he's, you know, aggressive and tough and gave the Democrats the spinal transplant is what it was called. If you were the person that wanted to inject the phrase Michael Moore Democrat into the mainstream, your dream would be to have Howard Dean be chairman of the Democratic National Committee.
But let's talk about the accuracy of the term itself. You said on the one hand, Michael Moore-ism can represent any kind of left-wing position that you don't like. But the fact is, when you try to apply it, it never, ever makes sense, not even in connection with Howard Dean, who is pretty centrist in his policies, except with regard to the war in Iraq.
Look, Michael Moore is identified with a few things. He's identified with opposition to the war. which Howard Dean is also identified with. He's identified with being pro-union. His origins come from protesting corporations. It's interesting that he sort of transitioned from that into, you know, geopolitics.
But basically, he's not being defined by the political positions he took at all, but by the fact that he's obnoxious.
Yes. So Michael Moore Democrat means obnoxious Democrat, then.
Have you encountered anybody who has self-identified as a Michael Moore Democrat?
I have not. I mean, that was one of the big criticisms of Peter Beinart's piece was, look, is Michael Moore really one of the two major figures in the Democratic Party? Is he really in charge of a wing of the Democratic Party? No. I mean, even people who like him know that he's unfair and biased and obnoxious and sometimes dishonest. But they think, hey, you know what? He's funny.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Chris Sullentrop is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Slate.
Mr. Speaker and members, I dedicate my objection to Ohio's electoral votes to Mr. Michael Moore.
Coming up, after-school specials, The Latchkey Kid's Best Friend, and Mom and Dad, the movie. Not suitable for children.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of grant making, on the web at wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Are those documents authentic, as experts consulted by CBS News continue to maintain? Or were they forgeries or recreations? We will keep an open mind, and we will continue to report credible evidence and responsible points of view as we try to answer the questions raised about the authenticity of the documents.
Well, okay, we have the answers, or at least some of them. According to the independent investigation of Memogate, CBS News rushed to the air with a haphazardly reported story about the president's National Guard service without knowing if the memos cited in the story were real or fake. The tally of repercussions? 4 producers fired, Dan Rather giving up his evening news anchor chair, and cackles of delight from the political right, who claim vindication in their mantra that CBS News and the like have it in for the president and the GOP. I think, said Republican political consultant Keith Apple, it's a warning to the rest of the media. Yeah, a warning. Straighten up and fly right. Well, don't expect the Fox newsification of CBS, but also don't expect that shelved 60 Minutes report on the bogus Iraq-Niger uranium deal to air anytime soon. It's worth noting that the panel found no evidence of political bias, just shoddy reporting in the race for a big scoop. It's also worth noting that the underlying story about favoritism for Lieutenant George Bush during the Vietnam War has been amply documented by other news organizations, notably the Boston Globe and Associated Press. It's also worth noting that the Memogate investigation itself never determined that the disputed memos were forged. Doesn't really matter. What the public will see is smoking gun evidence of media bias, which means that any lies and misdeeds of the GOP, when exposed by an occasionally vigilant press, can be more easily dismissed. It's the modified OJ defense. It's the bias card. Pay no attention to my footprints, my flight from prosecution, and the victim's blood in my car. You're out to get me because I'm Republican. Never mind that the administration's notion of answering to the public is, as we learned last week, to bribe columnists to print propaganda. Never mind the press's constitutional role as watchdog over every government in power. Never mind truth. The reality is, OJ was acquitted. It's hard to know whom to resent more. The Bush administration, now freer than ever to hide from public scrutiny, or the scoundrels and screw-ups who delivered that impunity on a silver platter. Were you a latchkey kid in the 70s or the 80s? And do you feel that with a little moral guidance, things usually work out for the best? If you answered yes to both questions, then you probably logged a few after-school hours watching ABC's after-school specials. The one-hour dramas aired in the after-school hours from 1972 to 1988, and now you can relive the whole thing. They've just been released on DVD. In case you aren't of the Christy McNichol generation, the after-school specials covered real teen issues like bullying, drinking, and sex. They were melodramatic, hysterical, and hokey, but for all of that, they ran for nearly 20 years, won Emmys, film festivals, and even a Peabody Award. We sent Sarah Lemanchek to see how they play in 2005.
Everybody who grew up in the 70s and 80s remembers them, or at least remembers that electric mix of young stars, campy tragedy, and good, solid moral lessons.
There was one I remember that I think it was about a basketball player. He was in high school.
I remember we were forced to watch him in health class, and I remember Scott Baio freaking out on drugs and getting hit over the head in the water.
There's a good one about gonorrhea, I remember.
And somehow, I think it was his little brother burnt his eyes with some bleach, and this basketball player couldn't read the back of the bottle to get him some help to flush his eyes with water. And I think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was somehow a guest star on it.
But aside from titillating details about sex or illuminating the inevitable tragedy of mixing illiteracy with bleach, there was a real effort behind these stories to look into the lives of teenagers and to address them, not as children or adults, but as something in between, which was pretty startling. Media writer for the Chicago Tribune, Maureen Ryan.
Well, I think it was something in the culture. I just remember in the 70s we had the book Free to Be You and Me. We had books like, you know, Our Bodies, Ourselves. I remember, you know, looking around my friends' houses for The Joy of Sex and finding it in, you know, some secret drawer. It just seemed like there was much more of an air of exploration in terms of topics that might now today be considered inappropriate for kids or young adults.
If adults could have dirty, messy lives, then suddenly it seemed that perhaps teenagers did too, at least the teens on the ABC after-school specials. Like Christy McNichol as a foster kid, obsessed with her own isolation.
Listen, Carly.
No, you listen. Me and Harvey and Thomas J. were like pinballs. Somebody came along with a dime, put it in, pushed a button, and out we came, ready or not. You don't see pinballs helping each other now, do you? Because they can't. They're just things.
I think really what made them so compelling was that, you know, if you think about probably the most popular series starring, you know, teenagers or alleged teenagers in the 70s was Happy Days. And, you know, while series like Maude and All in the Family were exploring social issues in a really compelling way, I don't think there was as much that was aimed at or dealt with young people on primetime television. It was just like, oh my gosh, they're really talking about this on TV, and you know, it's for young people. It just seemed out of step almost with what was happening in primetime as far as younger people were concerned.
Happy Days premiered in 1974, around the same time the ABC after-school specials were picking up momentum. So if you were 12, you had two models of real life on TV, one where the central plot was who will take Joni to the fall social, and in a pinch you knew it'd be Fonzie, or a high school girl staging a fire drill by climbing out her bedroom window in case her alcoholic mother burnt the house down.
Francesca, how could you? What are you trying to do?
We're having a fire drill.
A what?
A fire drill. You start drinking and then smoke in bed. So what else could we do? We have to protect ourselves.
Alateen-inspired fire drills might not be typical. In fact, a hallmark of the ABC after-school special became the extreme nature of the lives portrayed on the screen. But they did acknowledge that there was more to adolescence than sock hops.
The after-school special just depicted more or less average kids doing average things and having average or above average or maybe a little bit slightly unrealistic problems. But there was a completely wonderful earnestness about them. They just took these young adult novels that are still well-respected and turned them into these little tales that kids could kind of identify with and relate to.
Fast forward a few years. The ABC specials ended in 1988. 2 years later, the Fox network came out with Beverly Hills 90210, a serial drama revolving around a group of teenagers, fashion, and money. Through this gaggle of rich, overprivileged kids, Fox explored teen complexities like alcoholism, divorce, drug use, sex, rape, eating disorders, and what it's like to get a Porsche for your 16th birthday. And a new trope was formed.
Yeah, I think the legacy for us was the second generation one. I mean, you know, it went After School Special to 90210, and I suppose we're picking up the baton from 90210.
Josh Schwartz is the 28-year-old executive producer for The OC, the latest and hottest incarnation of teen TV, which somehow doesn't feel that different from Pinballs. Sure, you'd have to make some sort of PS2 reference, and everyone would look a lot flashier than Christy McNichol ever did. But despite that, Josh at least seems earnest in his desire to help.
We take it very seriously that we have younger viewers, and we believe the best way to reach that audience is to create an honest conversation with them in which you're just showing behavior, but not necessarily glamorizing it. And when the consequences are shown for that behavior, it has a lot more of an impact. So we don't necessarily say Marissa drinking is a bad thing. However, her life and the consequences of her drinking certainly won't inspire anyone to go pick up the bottle.
You can almost see the ABC After School Special peeking out behind all those Prada bags. Melodrama, extreme situations, and yes, morality. Like when the character Ryan finds out his girlfriend is pregnant.
She got pregnant, and he did the right thing, and as far as he knew, went to stand by her and help her through that and be a supportive and loving, you know, father, even if it wasn't his child. No one took a position with Ryan and sort of reprimanded him, but he definitely had to endure the consequences of his actions.
And we learned all about those consequences in the 1980 Schoolboy Father with Rob Lowe and Dana Plato. Only Rob Lowe's consequences lasted for about an hour, whereas in The OC, a teen pregnancy can hang out in the subplot for an entire season, lurking behind countless party scenes, fast cars, and endless days of teen ennui. But whether it's an hour or a season, kids still identify with a floundering teen or 25-year-old adult, even if they're driving an SUV instead of their mom's station wagon.
What's amazing to me is how much they relate to the characters, because you would think that their situations are totally unrelatable. But, I mean, the show is at its core about what it's like to be an outsider. And so many kids go to school every day feeling that way. But there's also elements of, you know, the music the kids listen to, the references they make, the clothes they wear. There's that connection as well. But I think the emotional lives of the characters ring true.
There's much more of an emphasis on how to make this cool, how to make it hip.
But critic Maureen Ryan is still holding a candle for the ABC After School Specials.
That's what was great about these shows. They didn't really pretend that kids had all the answers or knew how to dress or knew how to act or had the right kind of friends. They sort of just assumed that kids were flailing around and didn't necessarily know what to do in their lives. And now I find that kids who are supposedly 16-year-old characters on TV have lives far more complex and sort of racy than I think my life is right now.
The lives of teens on TV were never about reality, whether it's Joni Cunningham or The OC's Marissa Cooper. And really, Helen Hunt throwing herself out the window the first time she tried Angel Dust isn't totally realistic either. But behind the morals and the hyperbolic plots, the ABC specials devoted 1 hour of programming to one kid and one problem. And then they did something revolutionary. They said it mattered. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
Now roll back the time machine a few more decades to the 1940s. Teens were in peril then, too. Not necessarily from sniffing angel dust, but definitely from breathing in each other's pheromones. It was a nervous time and a perfect time for sex educator / snake oil salesman Kroger Babb. His magic potion was a movie, disarmingly titled Mom and Dad. And unlike the later after-school specials, it was not designed to reassure kids, but to titillate and terrify their parents. This was tough love for grown-ups, intended to expose the horrible consequences of sexual ignorance.
Who was the boy? I'll have him arrested.
Dave didn't tell me his name, and I didn't ask. After all, why blame the boy?
But you wouldn't blame such a scandalous thing on an innocent young girl like Joan.
No, I wouldn't blame her any more than I would the boy.
Well, then who would you blame?
I'd blame you, Mrs. Blake. You and every parent who neglects the sacred duty of telling their children the real truth.
Joe Bob Briggs is an author, erstwhile TV movie host, and a columnist for UPI. He wrote about Mom and Dad and Kroger Babb for Reason magazine in 2003 when we spoke to him.
If you lived in a small town in the 40s or 50s or even 60s, because this movie ran for 30 years, sooner or later, publicity man would show up in town and ads would appear and a debate would occur and there would be letters to the editor in the paper. You would get all the ballyhoo leading up to the one-week-only screenings of Mom and Dad. Kroger Babb billed himself as America's fearless young showman. And he had an army of these Mom and Dad roadshow units that went all over the country, at one time as many as 40 of them on the road all at the same time.
And as part of his advance strategy, he would sometimes write the angry letters to the editor, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was a master at writing fake letters to the editor, posing as a pastor in another town that had already had Mom and Dad and saying, never let this film show there. They would also occasionally try to get court injunctions filed against their own film. You know, and one time they were successful, and then they had to go into court and argue against their own injunction. But, yeah, anything to create controversy about the film.
And so when the projector rolled, what exactly would the audience see?
The whole first hour is devoted to showing how this sweet, pretty young girl has her life ruined because she goes to a local dance and she's swept off her feet by a handsome and worldly pilot who steals a kiss, and then he overwhelms her after that in his roadster on Lover's Lane and convinces her that two people as much in love as they are should definitely go all the way. Slow fade, okay?
Right.
Shortly thereafter, he leaves town on business. Then she gets a letter that he's been killed in an accident on the same day that she discovers she's worried about her hygiene.
In other words, she is in trouble, in trouble, in trouble. That phrase is used throughout the film. The P word, however, is never invoked.
Never use the word pregnancy in the entire film.
Now, the truly titillating material, though, the stuff that everybody was really there to see, was actually tucked deep in the show and arrives in the form of a film within a film?
Yeah. In one of the clumsiest segues ever, one of the teachers at the high school says, we need a class in social hygiene so these things don't happen again. And somebody mentions, oh, I know this specialist, Dr. Ashley. And the next scene you see Dr. Ashley talking to a high school class of girls, and he shows a film called The Facts of Life. And it looks, you know, just like a normal film about the menstrual cycle, and has some drawings of the genital organs. And then, whap, suddenly, without warning, graphic footage of a live birth. Then you haven't quite recovered from that. And they show a second film called Modern American Surgery that has an actual cesarean section on camera. Then, two scenes later, just when you think you've seen all you can see, there's a third film within the film called Seeing is Believing, and this is the coup de grace of the whole thing. It's every teenage boy's nightmare. It's got all these syphilis victims with their rotting teeth and their bodies with open sores, and all these silent movie-style captions that say, the price of ignorance. Self-styled moralists would like to keep these facts a secret, things of this nature.
You know, what's interesting about Mom and Dad is that it allowed moviegoers to get off on images of Pickles and Beaver, as they were known, and yet still walk away with their sense of moral integrity intact.
And now, friends, you've seen the entire production. If you agree that these pictures have been bold and shocking enough, that you've learned a very worthwhile lesson from them, I wish you'd show the management your appreciation at this time by your applause.
Notice that he says two things that are contradictory. He says, if you believe these things are bold and shocking, and if you believe these things are educational, show the management by your applause. And, of course, that was the genius of the promotion, that you could appeal to a man's baser instincts and yet let him justify seeing this footage by his educational mission.
Well, Joe Bob Briggs, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Joe Bob Briggs is the author of Profoundly Disturbing, The Shocking Movies That Changed Cinema.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jameson York, and Ann Kosseff, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had editing help from Arun Roth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. And email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. Women's e-news. News every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. Online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.